This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz, and today on the show, we're asking this question. What's your biggest fear? Can you describe the day of a launch? Like, what happens on that day?
Oh, yeah. It's beyond butterflies.
This is Chris Hadfield. He's
an astronaut, a retired astronaut. I was 21 years an astronaut. I've launched off the planet 3 times.
And the thing about those space launches, the odds of a catastrophic accident were 1 in 35.
It's like a that feeling in a roller coaster, I think, where you get into that little chain thing that drags you up the hill to make the ride begin.
Right.
And the closer you get to the top, you see more and more of the world, and there's sort of this, okay, nothing bad's happening right now, but this process is leading to something. And our process is like 20 years that leads, so it's 20 years of up the hill. And that last day is where suddenly you come over that crest and you're away. So you wake up in quarantine somewhere where they've been protecting you from catching a head cold. I don't know, there's sort of a wedding feel to it of all of these practiced and unusual places where there's a whole bunch of expectant people and you're wearing clothes you don't normally wear, and it builds. It builds in complexity, and it definitely builds in danger. Until finally, after all of the preliminaries,
T-minus 17 seconds to count.
You are wearing the right outfit, and you're sitting in the right seat.
12, 11.
There's an enormous amount of fuel gurgling and then jostling in the tanks down underneath you, in between you and the Earth.
Start.
And somewhere there's a spark, and
ignition.
Bam! Some unseen giant just stuck his foot in the small of your back and is now hurling you. With a lot of vibration and very little pity.
Huh.
And you're along for that ride.
Some shuttles have reached through the sound guarding room.
So what's the scariest thing you've done, Chris?
The scariest thing I've done is ride a rocket ship to space.
Today on the show, what we fear. Ideas about making sense out of our fears and the possibilities we find when we actually embrace them. And over the next hour, 5 TED speakers who reveal the things that scare them the most. Like
just people. What people are thinking.
One of my most vivid fears is being on a plane, imagining it crashing.
I'm scared of speaking on the phone.
Is there anything that you're afraid of right now?
No.
Ground control to Major Tom.
So in the case of Chris Hadfield, he probably never would have made it up there in the first place if he hadn't learned something about fear and really how to deal with it. Oh, and if you were wondering, Chris Hadfield is, in fact, that astronaut.
This is ground control to Major Tom.
He recorded a pitch-perfect cover of David Bowie's Space Oddity on the International Space Station, and he was one of just 200 or so people who have ever been on the space station. Chris Hadfield picks up the story from the TED stage.
It's an amazing experience, but how do you deal with the danger of it and the fear that comes from it?
How do you deal with fear versus danger? And having the goal in mind, thinking about where it might lead to be able to launch and go help build a space station where you are on board a million-pound creation that's going around the world at 5 miles a second, to be able to look down the jaw-dropping gorgeousness of the turning orb like a self-propelled art gallery of fantastic, constantly changing beauty that is the world itself. And you see, because of the speed, a sunrise or a sunset every 45 minutes for half a year. And the most magnificent part of all that is to go outside on a spacewalk. You are in a one-person spaceship. That is your spacesuit. And you're going through space with the world. It's an entirely different perspective. You're not looking up at the universe. You and the Earth are going through the universe together. And you are holding on with one hand, one link to the other 7 billion people.
Do you remember a time early on in your career as an astronaut where, the first time that you were afraid of something? Not just nervous, but afraid.
Yeah, fear is a autonomic reaction to perceived danger. If they grabbed you right now and stuck you in the cockpit of the space shuttle and said, "Okay, we're launching in 15 minutes,"
I would say, "Stop! Don't!"
And if you can't stop it, and if you touch any of the wrong switches, you kill yourself and everybody on board. Then you would be rightly terrified. But in our case, it's the opposite. They say, "Okay, you're pre-selected. You're choosing yourself. But also, 15 years from now, we're going to put you in the cockpit. We're going to teach you so much about every single switch that you will know them more intimately than anything you've ever known anything in your life." And so you're so aware. It's like you're playing a harp. And I think if someone handed me a harp and told me we were now playing in the symphony, I'd be kind of terrified too. But if you spend the years in advance, it becomes more like beautiful music that you're part of and less like just a daunting, scary, petrifying thing. And the only time I really remember that happening in my career as an astronaut was watching a huge meteorite burn up in the atmosphere while I was in orbit.
Wow.
I was looking down at the world. I was looking at Australia at night, which is nice because everybody lives on the coast. It's kind of like a necklace. But I was looking at Australia in the night by myself, and then a big meteorite came blundering into the atmosphere. And at first, my reaction was, "Oh, well, look at that, a shooting star from space." And it was a big one. It took several seconds to burn out. So it was quite scenic. But then immediately after sort of marveling at the beauty of it, I recognized that that was just a dumb rock from the universe that was probably going, 20 miles a second, that just came screaming in between me and the planet. And it could have just as easily been 100 miles higher and smucked right into the side of us. A completely random event that I couldn't have done anything about, no matter how much I train, that would have obliterated our crew and our vehicle right away. And that, the randomness of it, the lack of ability to do anything about it, that sent a shiver up my back of just straight animal fear.
Why do you do it? I mean, why take the risk?
I think if you're going to take any risk in life, if you're going to expose yourself to any danger, it's worth asking why. For me, if I'm going to take a risk, I want it to be for a purpose. I want it to have a reason and also something that I have some control over so that I can help be master of my own destiny and fate, at least to some degree. That's sort of the essence of exploration.
The last time Chris came back from space, it was in a Russian capsule called the Soyuz. And he was hurtling back to Earth at 755 feet per second.
And in essence, you are riding a meteorite home. And riding meteorites is scary. And it ought to be. But instead of riding into the atmosphere, just screaming like you would if suddenly you found yourself riding a meteorite back to Earth, instead, 20 years previously, we had started studying Russian. And then once you learned Russian, then we learned orbital mechanics in Russian. And then we learned vehicle control theory. And then we got into the simulator and practiced over and over and over again. And in fact, you can fly this meteorite and steer it and land in about a 15-kilometer circle anywhere on the Earth. So in fact, when our crew was coming back into the atmosphere inside the Soyuz, we weren't screaming, we were laughing. It was fun. So we came thundering back to Earth, and then eventually the Russians reach in, drag you out, plunk you into a chair, and you can now look back at what was an incredible experience. You have taken the dreams of that 9-year-old boy, which were impossible and dauntingly scary, and figured out a way to reprogram yourself, to change your primal fear so that it allowed you to come back with a set of experiences and a level of inspiration for other people that never could have been possible otherwise.
Do you think most of our fears are irrational?
I think fear is good. I think fear keeps you alive. Mm-hmm. You know, if the saber-toothed tiger comes bursting out of the bushes, you want to be the fastest running person around, and you want, you know, to have superhuman strength and all the rest of it. But most people through their entire lives respond to a perceived danger, sort of amorphous danger. And we put it behind the category of I'm afraid of getting married, driving a race car, I'm afraid of whatever. Yeah, it's easy to say. But in a modern, much more constrained world where the saber-toothed tigers very seldom come jumping out of the bushes, I should maybe try and change my caveman fear reaction to things if I can evolve it some and instead experience the opportunities that exist in life and don't let those primal fears be the main dictator of the life that results.
Astronaut Chris Hadfield, you can find his talk at TED.com. Though I've flown 100,000 miles. Did he ever, like, get in touch with you and say, hey, you know, nice job, or...
Oh, yeah, he said it was the best cover of the song ever done.
Wow!
Yeah, that's
Bowie
what I
told
thought.
You that?
Yeah, he sent us an email.
The
yeah.
best cover of Bowie ever from Bowie.
Well, I had a pretty good soundstage up there.
More stories and ideas about fear in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, ideas about fear. For the novelist Karen Thompson Walker, it's all a matter of what we learn from it, because fear
comes to you as sort of a fully formed story.
There's a story that Karen was thinking about right after that horrible earthquake and tsunami in Indonesia in 2004. She came across an article that mentioned the force of that earthquake, and it was so powerful
that it had affected the rotation of the Earth. And I remember I've had sort of a creepy, fearful feeling in that moment. You know, the idea that something I had always taken for granted as stable and steady and predictable, the idea that that was in flux, it sort of scared me for a moment. And rather than just imagining all the frightening consequences in our real world, I started to imagine, you know, what if I wrote a story?
And that was how she came up with the idea for her novel, Age of Miracles, which is about a family that wakes up one morning, and on that morning, the Earth's rotation has suddenly slowed down.
I tend to have both an interest in and a fear of, you know, catastrophe, which is why I write about it so much. A certain kind of fear has always been part of my life. You know, ever since I was a child, I feel like I was the one who was quick to kind of imagine disaster. You know, I grew up in California, so earthquakes, that was a big fear of mine. You know, what would happen if an earthquake struck in the middle of the night?
Yeah, I grew up in California, too, and I totally remember that feeling. Like, we had a bunk bed, and my little brother slept underneath, and I slept on top, and I was constantly waking up at night, like, worrying about, you know, what if there was an earthquake, that like, the top bunk would collapse on my brother and crush him to death.
Oh, no. See, fears can be so vivid and specific,
yeah.
You know?
Like, I fear flying. I hate flying.
Me too.
I get so scared when I fly.
One of my most vivid fears is being on a plane, imagining it crashing. And that's one that actually, you know, that's something that's a kind of an unlikely scenario that something bad would happen on a plane. But it's the most vivid. You can sort of see the story unfolding. There's something about that vividness that can kind of obsess the mind, at least my mind.
So when Karen stepped onto the TED stage, she opened with a story that happened nearly 200 years ago, and it's a story about, well, catastrophe and fear.
One day in 1819, 3,000 miles off the coast of Chile, in one of the most remote regions of the Pacific Ocean, 20 American sailors watched their ship flood with seawater. They'd been struck by a sperm whale, which had ripped a catastrophic hole in the ship's hull. As their ship began to sink beneath the swells, the men huddled together in three small whaleboats. These men were 10,000 miles from home and more than 1,000 miles from the nearest scrap of land. In their small boats, they carried only rudimentary navigational equipment and limited supplies of food and water. These were the men of the whale ship Essex, whose story would later inspire parts of Moby Dick. So most of us have never experienced a situation as frightening as the one in which these sailors found themselves, but we all know what it's like to be afraid. We know how fear feels, but I'm not sure we spend enough time thinking about what our fears mean. As we grow up, we're often encouraged to think of fear as a weakness, just another childish thing to discard, like baby teeth or roller skates. So maybe that's why we think of fear sometimes as a danger in and of itself. Fear is something we conquer. It's something we fight, something we overcome. But what if we looked at fear in a fresh way? What if we thought of fear as an amazing act of the imagination, something that can be as profound and insightful as storytelling itself? Well, let's return to the year 1819 for a moment, to the situation facing the crew of the whale ship Essex. Let's take a look at the fears that their imaginations were generating as they drifted in the middle of the Pacific. 24 hours had now passed since the capsizing of the ship. The time had come for the men to make a plan, but they had very few options. The men knew that the nearest islands they could reach were the Marquesa Islands, 1,200 miles away. But they'd heard some frightening rumors. They'd been told that these islands and several others nearby were populated by cannibals. So the men pictured coming ashore only to be murdered and eaten for dinner. Another possible destination was Hawaii, but given the season, the captain was afraid they'd be struck by severe storms. Now, the last option was the longest and the most difficult, to sail 1,500 miles due south in hopes of reaching a certain band of winds that could eventually push them toward the coast of South America. But they knew that the sheer length of this journey would stretch their supplies of food and water. To be eaten by cannibals, to be battered by storms, to starve to death before reaching land. These were the fears that danced in the imaginations of these poor men. And as it turned out, the fear they chose to listen to would govern whether they lived or died.
It's that moment of decision when these men had to make a decision about, you know, which way would give them the best chance of survival. And it's that moment of choosing between these competing options and, in a way, each one with its own risks and associated fears. It's that moment that kind of fascinates me the most about the story.
So what's happening in our minds when our fears turn into stories?
Well, I think it happens kind of unintentionally. I think fear is itself kind of subconscious or unconscious form of storytelling, you know, so it has the same architecture. So it's a beginning and a middle and an end, you know, which in the end is bad. You know, you say you hear a noise in the house And then you think someone might, you know, some sort of intruder has come into the house, and soon they're going to come into your room, and you don't have to do anything. You're sort of receiving the story. Just comes to us kind of subconsciously.
Our fears also tend to contain imagery that can be every bit as vivid as what you might find in the pages of a novel. Picture a cannibal, human teeth sinking into human skin, human flesh roasting over a fire. Just like all great stories, our fears focus our attention on a question that is as important in life as it is in literature. What will happen next? So if we think of our fears as more than just fears, but as stories, we should think of ourselves as the authors of those stories. But just as importantly, we need to think of ourselves as the readers of our fears. And how we choose to read our fears can have a profound effect on our lives.
Do you think we need it?
Fear?
Yeah.
Oh, I think we definitely need it. You know, when in those rare times when you do face a life or death situation, then fear is essential. I mean, that's your best chance to survive a terrible situation because, you know, it makes you think very quickly about the possible scenarios and hopefully make a quick decision. Yeah, I think it's definitely a necessary part of human life. And it also keeps us from taking unnecessary or reckless risks. You know, you need to have that built-in fear of consequences.
So how can we tell the difference between the fears worth listening to and all the others? I think the end of the story of the whale ship Essex offers an illuminating, if tragic, example. After much deliberation, the men finally made a decision. Terrified of cannibals, they decided to forego the closest islands and instead embarked on the longer and much more difficult route to South America. After more than 2 months at sea, the men ran out of food. When the last of the survivors were finally picked up by two passing ships, less than half of the men were left alive, and some of them had resorted to their own form of cannibalism. So the question is, why did these men dread cannibals so much more than the extreme likelihood of starvation? The novelist Vladimir Nabokov said that the best reader has a combination of two very different temperaments, the artistic and the scientific. As we've seen, the men of the Essex had no trouble with the artistic part. They dreamed up a variety of horrifying scenarios. The problem was, of all the narratives their fears wrote, they responded only to the most lurid, the most vivid, the one that was easiest for their imaginations to picture, cannibals. But perhaps if they'd been able to read their fears more like a scientist, with more coolness of judgment, they would have listened instead to the less violent but the more likely tale, the story of starvation. And maybe if we all tried to read our fears, we too would be less often swayed by the most salacious among them. Maybe then we'd spend less time worrying about serial killers and plane crashes, and more time concerned with the subtler and slower disasters we face, the silent buildup of plaque in our arteries, the gradual changes in our climate. Read in the right way, our fears are an amazing gift of the imagination, a kind of everyday clairvoyance, a way of glimpsing what might be the future when there's still time to influence how that future will play out. Properly read, our fears can offer us something as precious as our favorite works of literature, a little wisdom, a bit of insight, and a version of that most elusive thing, the truth. Thank you.
Karen Thompson Walker, her talk is called What Fear Can Teach Us. Check it out at ted.npr.org.
Are you afraid right now?
Afraid, maybe.
This is Joe Cowan.
I'm a little nervous.
By day, he's a mild-mannered graphic designer.
It's nerve-wracking being on public radio with, like, millions of people listening.
Yeah, well, that's not helping.
Don't worry, nobody's listening now. It's just me and you.
Yeah. Would be nice if my body believed it.
Okay, there's a couple of things you need to know about Joe. First of all,
I have stage fright,
which you might already have guessed. And that would be fine, because a lot of people are completely terrified of getting on stage. Except Joe, he's also a folk singer.
So the funny thing is, I've always wanted to be able to be in front of people, be able to perform, be able to sing songs and do that kind of thing. So in my head, I've always been like, I've totally got this. I can do this and all this. But then in reality, whenever I've been presented with that opportunity, it just seems like a different thing is going on.
When did you first like notice that you were afraid to be up in front of people?
So I remember trying out for the school play and I remember going up there and then my voice just going like for every note throughout the whole entire song. And I was just like, how could this be happening? I mean, why can't I fix that?
Do you think anybody noticed?
Everyone noticed.
And so for years, Joe just avoided getting on stage. He didn't perform in front of anyone until he realized that he really wanted to do it. And he didn't want his stage fright to hold him back. Joe picks up the story in his TED Talk.
On the week of my 30th birthday, I decided I was going to go to this local open mic and put this fear behind me. Well, when I got there, it was packed. There were like 20 people there. And they all looked angry. But I took a deep breath, and I signed up to play, and I felt pretty good, until about 10 minutes before my turn, when my whole body rebelled and this wave of anxiety just washed over me. Now, when you experience fear, your sympathetic nervous system kicks in, so you have a rush of adrenaline. Your heart rate increases, your breathing gets faster. Next, your non-essential systems start to shut down, like digestion. So your mouth gets dry and blood is routed away from your extremities so your fingers don't work anymore. Your pupils dilate, your muscles contract, your spidey sense tingles. Basically, your whole body is trigger happy. That condition is not conducive to performing folk music. I mean, your nervous system is an idiot. Really, 200,000 years of human evolution, and it still can't tell the difference between a saber-toothed tiger and 20 folk singers on a Tuesday night open mic? I have never been more terrified until now. Then it was my turn, and somehow I get myself onto the stage, I start my song, I open my mouth to sing the first line, and this completely horrible vibrato, you know, when your voice wavers, comes streaming out. And this is not the good kind of vibrato like an opera singer has. This is my whole body just convulsing with fear. I mean, it's a nightmare. I'm embarrassed. The audience is clearly uncomfortable. They're focused on my discomfort. It was so bad.
So you understand, like, intuitively why this happens, right? Because our body is designed to protect us. Like, we're designed to survive.
Yeah, I mean, you know, if you're in danger, your body does certain things to get you out of danger, whether that means run away.
Yeah, it wants you to get away from the tiger, yeah. And like, that part of our brain just hasn't changed. Like, it's still there, and it can't really, like, figure out the context sometimes.
And you know, maybe that's a good thing, because you wouldn't want it to mess up. If there really was a tiger in your room, you don't want to be like, oh, I got this, I'm pretty relaxed. It's just a tiger.
That night I promised myself I would go back every week until I wasn't nervous anymore. And I did. I went back every single week. And sure enough, week after week, it didn't get any better. The same thing happened every week. I couldn't shake it. And that's when I had an epiphany. And I remember it really well because I don't have a lot of epiphanies. All I had to do was write a song that exploits my nervousness, that only seems authentic when I have stage fright. And the more nervous I was, the better the song would be. Easy. So I started writing a song about having stage fright. First, fessing up to the problem, the physical manifestations, how I would feel, how the listener might feel, and then accounting for things like my shaky voice, and I knew I would be singing about a half octave higher than normal because I was nervous. By having a song that explained what was happening to me while it was happening, that gave the audience permission to think about it. They didn't have to feel bad for me because I was nervous. They could experience that with me, and we were all one big, happy, nervous, uncomfortable family. By thinking about my audience, by embracing and exploiting my problem, I was able to take something that was blocking my progress and turn it into something that was essential for my success. And having the stage fright song let me get past that biggest issue right in the beginning of a performance. And then I could move on and play the rest of my songs with just a little bit more ease. And eventually, you know, over time, I didn't have to play the stage fright song at all. Except for when I was really nervous. Like now. Would it be okay if I played the stage fright song for you? I'm not joking, you know, this stage fright is real. And if I'm up here trembling and singing, well, you'll know how I feel. And the mistake I'd be making, the tremolo caused by my whole body shaking, as you sit there feeling embarrassed for me, well, you don't have to be. Maybe just a little bit.
Eventually, I mean, it sounds like you did it, that you conquered your fear, right?
I conquered it a little bit. You know, if I am in front of an audience, if I'm playing music every week or twice a week, I do relax, and over time, I just kind of settle into that thing. But if I stop for a couple of weeks or a month or longer, and when I go back to it, it's like I have to start over. It's always a setback. It's never cured forever. It's never cured forever.
Joe Cowan, graphic designer by day, folk singer by night. You can hear his full talk at TED.com. Our episode this week, What We Fear. In a moment, a freak of nature, a man who fears nothing. Stay with us. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour. From NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. Our show today, all about our fears. And some people just don't have them.
David has been standing on that pillar for well over 34 hours. No net, no safety wires.
So magician David Blaine does these amazing, death-defyingly scary stunts, like when he stood atop a 100-foot pillar in Bryant Park for a day and a half. He's also been encased in a massive block of ice in Times Square for 63 hours.
Soaking wet. To remind you, for 3 days he's had no food.
He's lived in a plexiglass box suspended over the Thames River in London for 44 days.
For 40 days, he had no food, but his body did, his own.
And all these stunts were very public and very scary. What's been, like, the scariest thing? Where you've sort of, for a moment, thought, God, I don't know if I should do this.
A moment where... let me think. There's got to be one. Hold on.
Are you afraid of failing?
No way. Hmm. No way. I look at failing as the number one most important part of anything that I do.
So is there anything that you're afraid of right now?
No. I could say one thing now that I think about it, though. Like, if I have to go sleep in, like, a big house somewhere and no one else is there, I can't do it. I'd rather just sleep on the street.
And that fearlessness, it started when David Blaine was a kid. He tells the story in his TED Talk.
As a young magician, I was obsessed with Houdini and his underwater challenges. So I began early on competing against the other kids, seeing how long I could stay underwater while they went up and down to breathe, you know, five times while I stayed under on one breath. By the time I was a teenager, I was able to hold my breath for 3 minutes and 30 seconds. I would later find out that was Houdini's personal record. In 1987, I heard of a story about a boy that fell through ice and was trapped under a river. He was underneath, not breathing, for 45 minutes. When the rescue workers came, they resuscitated him, and there was no brain damage. His core temperature had dropped to 77 degrees. As a magician, I think everything is possible. And I think if something is done by one person, it can be done by others. I started to think if the boy could survive without breathing for that long, there must be a way that I could do it.
When you were a kid, right?
Yeah.
Did you ever feel like you felt differently about fear than other kids did?
You know, that's a really good question, and I had two components. Number one, I was raised by a single mother in Brooklyn, which was a pretty rough neighborhood at the time. So even though I was only 5 and 6, I was a fearless kid. I was a man at a young age. I was more of a man back then than I am now, actually. Mm. But number two is I was born with my feet turned in. I had certain things against me. I had asthma as a kid and things like that. So I wanted to make myself physically better and stronger, so I would run barefoot in the snow and hold my breath longer than all the other kids. So I think I started, like most kids are learning how to bounce a basketball or hit a baseball. I didn't have that behind me. I didn't have somebody teaching me those things, so I was kind of making up my own things.
And years later, David decided to get really serious about holding his breath. So he began to study those divers who don't use oxygen tanks, and he figured out how to slow down his heart rate. And in 3 months, he lost more than 50 pounds.
The thinner I was, the longer I was able to hold my breath. And by eating so well and training so hard, my resting heart rate dropped to 38 beats per minute, which is lower than most Olympic athletes. In 4 months of training, I was able to hold my breath for over 7 minutes. I decided that I was going to break the world record live on primetime television. So naturally, I decided to call Oprah.
After months of training,
David Blaine is about to risk his life on our stage.
Live in Chicago.
Okay, so cut to 2006. David's on a soundstage in Chicago underwater inside a giant glass sphere. And he's going for the world record.
The current record is 16 minutes. And 32 seconds.
But at around 10 minutes underwater, his mind started to drift to a very specific place.
So these next minutes are,
he tuned out the audience,
and the most dangerous.
And he thought of water. Water off the coast of Australia, where he spent many of his months training.
I just imagine them drifting in the ocean, them getting sucked into the abyss of the ocean, and I feel the sun shooting through the water, and you're with the sea creatures, and you don't need air, and there's no bubbles, so they swim next to you. And
we're at 14:30 right now, 14 minutes and 30 seconds.
And I look to my right, and I'm 200 feet deep, and there's a giant sea turtle swimming with me. And I look to my left, and there's a spotted ray on my left, and it's, you know, they're swimming. They're the guides.
We're 1 minute away from breaking the record.
Now look at his heart rate. It's starting to slow significantly.
So, you know, it's like an incredible feeling.
Come on.
Now, look at his heart rate is now in the 50s with extra heartbeats.
Come on, you can do it. You can do it.
And then suddenly I hear screaming.
Made it.
1646, he's beaten the record.
And I think that there's some weird thing that I had died or something had happened. And then I realized that I had made it to 1632. So with the energy of everybody that was there, I decided to keep pushing, and I went to 17 minutes and 4 seconds.
17 minutes. Breathe.
17 minutes. 4.4 seconds. Broke the world record.
David's record from 2008, by the way, has been beaten, most recently by someone in Germany in 2012 who was underwater for 22 minutes. David still holds his breath for 10 minutes every single night in his act, as well as stick an ice pick through his hand, chew glass, swallow kerosene. He really does these things each night, unafraid of death or injury. And the reason, he says, his mom.
When she was dying, she didn't have a shred of fear, or if she did, she didn't show me. She was very strong, very courageous, never complained, always paid attention to others. Even the day before she died, a little boy walked past her bedroom, and she was really out of it from all the morphine. And she said to the mother, because he didn't even walk into the room, he just walked past, and she went, "Oh, he got his hair cut. It looks so cute." So it was like she really paid very little attention to herself and was all over everybody else, but she made it appear to be beautiful. So I think she did that to protect me, but she never made it into something that was scary.
How many kids do you have?
One. She's three. She's, by the way, beyond fearless. Like, she pets the alligator, and she loves sharks. She's fearless.
Do you ever experience like the fear that a parent sometimes fear? Just like the fear.
Big time, enormous.
Right, right.
Yeah, even when she just like trips or something, I have a heart attack.
So see, I got you. You have fears. You have fears. You have a 3-year-old, and you're constantly, as a parent, you're constantly thinking, "Oh my God, is a car going to hit her? Is she okay? Is everything at daycare good? Is everything fine? Is a nanny doing it?" Like,
those things I don't fear, because what I do is I make every moment that I'm with her. I think it's more important to have, great, valuable, undistracted time and then hope that it can go on forever. But like I said, I didn't have my mother for as long as I would have liked to, but she was so strong in the moments that we were together that she's just as vibrant today in my life as she was when I was a kid.
That's magician David Blaine. His incredible talk can be found at ted.npr.org. If you think about like the things that we're most afraid of, It all comes down to death, right?
Exactly. Behind all of these fears, whether it's us being afraid of our plane crashing or a terrible fire or nuclear war, whatever it is, behind it lurks the Reaper.
This is Stephen Cave.
I'm a writer and philosopher, and I'm interested in the kind of stories we tell ourselves to help us cope with the fear of death.
And Stephen's been thinking about those kinds of stories since he was a kid. Here's how he opens his TED Talk.
Who here remembers when they first realized they were going to die? I do. I was a young boy, and my grandfather had just died. And I remember a few days later lying in bed at night, trying to make sense of what had happened. What did it mean that he was dead? Where had he gone? But then the really shocking question occurred to me: if he could die, could it happen to me too? And that's frightening. It's terrifying. And so we look for a way out. And in my case, as I was about 5 years old, this meant asking my mum. Now, when I first started asking what happens when we die, the grown-ups around me at the time answered with a typical English mix of awkwardness and half-hearted Christianity. And the phrase I heard most often was that Grandad was now up there looking down on us. And if I should die too, which wouldn't happen, of course, then I too would go up there. Which made death sound a lot like an existential elevator. Now, this didn't sound very plausible. I used to watch a children's news program at the time, and this was the era of space exploration. There were always rockets going up into the sky, up into space, going up there. But none of the astronauts, when they came back, ever mentioned having met my granddad or any other dead people. But I was scared, and so I believed it anyway, even though it didn't make much sense.
Wow, you were a precocious kid. Like, you were destined to be a philosopher.
I think all children are philosophers. All children are asking themselves these questions. We make sense of the world by telling ourselves stories. And in particular, we tell ourselves stories to make sense of things that don't otherwise seem to make sense, that defy understanding. And one of the big problems is, of course, death. So we tell ourselves these stories to help us cope with the fear of death. And there seem, when we look throughout history, to be an enormous diversity of different stories. But actually, I think when we look closely, we see there are just four basic forms that these immortality stories, if you like, can take.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of those stories?
So, the first one I'll call it the elixir story. Because in every culture in human history, there is some story of an elixir of life or a fountain of youth that promises we can live forever. But actually, if we look back through history, the one thing that all these elixir drinkers have in common is they're all now 6 foot under. So we need a backup plan.
And exactly this kind of plan B is what the second kind of immortality story offers, and that's resurrection. It accepts that I'm going to have to die, but says, despite that, I can rise up and I can live again. But our desire to believe this story is so deeply embedded that we are reinventing it again for the scientific age. For example, with the idea of cryonics. So some people believe an omnipotent God will resurrect them to live again, and other people believe an omnipotent scientist will do it.
But some people are skeptical about the idea of living on as a body. It's so messy. Instead, they dream of living on as a soul. Now, this is the third basic kind of immortality story, the idea that when you die, you can leave your body behind and live on as a spirit.
But of course, there are skeptics who say if we look at the evidence of science, particularly neuroscience, it suggests that your mind, your essence, the real you, is very much dependent on a particular part of your body, that is your brain. And such skeptics can find comfort in the fourth kind of immortality story, and that is legacy.
Like Achilles, for example, the great Greek warrior who fought and died in Troy knowing that if he did so, he would still be spoken about in years to come. And here we are 3,000 years later telling his story. Or, for example, the idea that you can live on through your children or through your nation or through your gene pool.
But again, there are skeptics who doubt whether legacy really is immortality. Woody Allen, for example, who said, "I don't want to live on in the hearts of my countrymen. I want to live on in my apartment."
And if you want to live on in your apartment, then of course what you need is an elixir, which is our first story. And so we're back to the beginning.
I mean, even though we have these stories to help us cope, I mean, the fear of death is sort of, it's like always there.
Yeah, these worries go through our minds all the time. There's no question there. And it's a struggle to keep them in perspective, to separate the fear that is natural from the fear that is actually rational. I mean, if you think for most of the evolution of our species, we were in the forest or in the jungle or in dangerous situations where really every single day could be our last, we're built to be scared. But we, because we've got these massive brains, we can generalize and abstract. And so we can worry about things that aren't even right in front of us. And so this sense that one day it's all going to be over is always with us.
Is it bad, though? I mean, is it, like, because death is real. We're all going to meet that end. So why is it irrational to have fear about it?
Now, this is a very good question, because it might seem like if there's one thing that we really ought to be afraid of, it's death.
Yeah.
It doesn't get worse than death. Death is the end of everything we care about. So we ought to be afraid of it, right? Well, on the one hand, I think it's completely natural to be afraid of death. And on the other hand, it's completely natural to want to live for as long as possible or for as long as you're enjoying life, to keep going. But being afraid of being dead, being afraid of what's on the other side, that is not rational. This is very hard to grasp because we're not very good at imagining not being, just stopping, ceasing to exist.
Now, I find it helps to see life as being like a book. Just as a book is bounded by its covers, by beginning and end, so our lives are bounded by birth and death. And even though a book is limited by beginning and end, it can encompass distant landscapes, exotic figures, fantastic adventures. And even though a book is limited by beginning and end, the characters within it know no horizons. They only know the moments that make up their story, even when the book is closed. And so the characters of a book are not afraid of reaching the last page. Long John Silver is not afraid of you finishing your copy of Treasure Island. And so it should be with us. Imagine the book of your life. Its covers, its beginning and end, are your birth and your death. You can only know the moments in between, the moments that make up your life. It makes no sense for you to fear what is outside of those covers, whether before your birth or after your death. And you needn't worry how long the book is, or whether it's a comic strip, or an epic. The only thing that matters is that you make it a good story. Thank you.
Stephen Cave, his book is called About Immortality. You can watch his full talk at ted.npr.org.
These things scare me. Maybe I just close my eyes and hide under my sheets. Scare me. Maybe I just close my eyes and hide under my sheets. Politicians and television, find out why you're gonna die. Depressed best friends, how the world ends. Stock market, blah, 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 equals dividends.
Hey, thanks for listening to our show about fear this week. If you missed any of it, or you want to hear more, or you want to find out more about who was on it, check out ted.npr.org. You can also find many more TED Talks at ted.com, and you can download this show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. Our program was produced by Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Sanaz Meshkinpour, with help from Rund Abdelfattah, Daniel Shukin, Portia Robertson-Migas, and Eric Newsom. Thanks to our partners at TED, Chris Anderson, June Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, are you still there? You're still listening to the show? All right, don't hit the pause button, because I have a recommendation for you. You should check out another NPR podcast. It's called Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. And every week, Jesse interviews writers, musicians, filmmakers, comedians, and just really cool people about their work and their lives. If you listen to Bullseye, we know from reliable empirical data that it will make you at least 10% cooler. This is all sourced to real data. You can find Bullseye on iTunes. Check it out.